At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
We've got pipelines, broadband access, cybersecurity, public transit. You could say today's program is sort of a series of tubes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 17th. Good to have you with us. More than 11,000 gas stations across the Southeast remain out of gas. Panic buying has drained over half the stations in North Carolina and nearly 70% of the pumps in Washington, D.C. This comes 5 days after the Colonial Pipeline resumed operations after a ransomware hack forced a shutdown. Tomorrow, Congress will launch a pipeline security bill to prevent future outages, but critics say it's still missing some major safeguards. Marketplace's Scott Tong kicks us off.
When something goes wrong with a pipeline, like the Colonial Pipeline hack, companies do not have to tell the government what happened. Electricity companies do. And if there's a plane incident, airlines have to open up to government investigators, says Rob Kanaki. He's a former top cybersecurity aide to President Obama.
They would be doing everything they could to understand what happened, and then they would rapidly be sharing that information with other airlines so those airlines could prevent the same thing from happening to them. That's not at all what's happening with this pipeline incident.
Instead, it's a voluntary system of protecting data and sharing information. There are no government mandates or fines, just recommendations. And the bill in Congress would keep it that way. Thing is, a recent survey of pipeline companies found that just 8% actively share information with the rest of the industry and the government.
That's a woefully low number.
Andy Lee at the law firm Jones Walker did the survey.
There's not enough carrots and there are too few sticks to ensure that our pipeline industry stakeholders are actively engaging in the budget spend to make sure that they are safe.
This isn't a new fight. 9 years ago, oil and gas lobbyists fought off mandatory rules, and now energy trade groups are again saying the industry should oversee itself. Mark Weatherford is dubious. He's strategy head at the National Cybersecurity Center, which advises government officials.
I am not a fan of regulation, and I hate to say it like this, but you know, it's been proven over and over again that companies are simply not going to self-regulate.
When the public safety is at stake, he says, the government needs a bigger role. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Big media news today. AT&T and Discovery announced they're forming a new company made up of their entertainment, news, and sports assets. The spinoff will put HBO, CNN, and TBS under the same roof as the Discovery Channel, HGTV, and the Food Network. AT&T gets some ownership in the new content giant and also gets out from under that $85 billion acquisition of Time Warner back in 2016. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on what's driving this deal.
AT&T has a lot going on. In addition to its media business, the company's in the middle of rolling out a nationwide 5G network and fiber broadband. It's also competing for wireless phone subscribers.
Each of those is an expensive proposition. So for AT&T, they just didn't have the money to fight three wars at once.
Craig Moffett is the founder of the research outfit Moffett Nathanson. Meanwhile, he says Discovery is trying to boost its own programming with a new streaming service called Discovery Plus.
But I think it's pretty clear that's not large enough on its own to be fully competitive with Disney and Netflix going forward.
Disney and Netflix are pouring billions of dollars into new content this year in order to lure new streaming subscribers. Jeffrey Cole directs the Center for the Digital Future at USC. If AT&T and Discovery want to compete, he says,
the only answer is to put billions into content. And I think you need a massive economic engine to do that.
Which the merged company would have, says analyst Jim Nail with Forrester Research. Combining AT&T offerings like HBO and CNN with Discovery content like HGTV and the Food Network, he says.
There's kind of something for everybody. So that may be a good justification for a household to spend whatever they're going to price it at.
He says one big challenge will be marketing the company and convincing users to sign up for yet another streaming service. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Elon Musk and Bitcoin are having a super messy breakup on Twitter, and it is some investment drama. Other market details when we do the numbers. So it is clear after the last 14 months or so that broadband internet access is essential. It's also clear that a whole lot of Americans don't have it. Closing the digital divide depends on knowing where access is available and where it isn't. The Federal Communications Commission is the agency charged with mapping the country's broadband access. But its maps are not great. Congress passed a law last year asking the agency to correct that, which leads me to Jessica Rosenworcel. She's the new acting chair of the FCC. I had her on the line earlier this month, and I asked her what actions she was taking to address the mapping issue.
In light of the law Congress passed, which is called the Broadband Data Act, I set up a task force that is looking at all the changes we can make in the short term, but also how we're going to have really accurate maps in the long term. And what's most important here is we can't just take in data from the carriers and assume it's correct. We have to go to individuals, local officials, and state officials and ask them what's really happening in their own backyard.
I mean, it sounds like you're describing a little bit of a broadband census.
I think we need it. When you think about how, as a nation, we've moved so much online during this pandemic, we've got to figure out how to get this service in a robust way everywhere. And I think it's appropriate to think about it that way.
I wonder now, though, we're at this moment where there's a lot of money all of a sudden between the CARES Act and the American Rescue Plan Act. We're seeing hundreds of millions of dollars going to municipalities, and some are using it to increase broadband access, you know, without waiting for new federal maps. Like, is the landscape changing even as you're undertaking this effort?
Yes. We have a lot of interest in this issue. You know, broadband's gone from nice to have to need to have. And everyone knows that, not just Congress. And I don't want to tell the people who don't have service, you know, just no, wait for until we have pristine data. We're going to have to sort of build this plane while it's in the air. And I think speed here matters. We don't want everyone to wait for us to have just perfect information before we start doing real things on the ground to connect more people.
I also just wonder about the power shift as you see this money flowing into municipalities. I think that there has been a sense that in some ways the conversation has been dominated by what big telecom companies have been willing to invest in and where. Do you have a sense that that power balance is shifting a little bit?
Yeah, I think that one of the realities of this infrastructure is there are really high sunk and fixed costs. And as a result, it gets deployed in places where companies can recover those costs faster. Those are often urban, suburban, more populated areas. So we're going to have to look at other alternatives, other ways, other technologies to make sure we serve 100% of us. And those might involve, you know, small local companies. That might involve fixed wireless or electric co-ops. We're going to have to get creative to make sure we get service everywhere.
Let's shift gears and talk about cost. Congress created a $3 billion fund for low-income Americans to receive $50 a month for broadband service. How will that also impact this landscape, especially as you are seeking other ways to lower costs.
Yeah, the program you mentioned is called the Emergency Broadband Benefit, and it's a really big deal because the United States has never had a big broadband affordability program. And so for the first time ever, we are going to be offering help to households where, you know, there's job loss or students are on the free and reduced lunch program. And there is a $50 a month support for that. And that support goes up to $75 a month on tribal lands. I think we have to study this program and see what good it did, who it was able to connect. Because I think if we study that data, we're going to learn more about what we need to do with respect to affordability in order to get everybody connected in this country.
Let's talk about everyone's favorite FCC chair conversation, net neutrality.
Well, you knew it was coming, right? You know?
Exactly. So you have been in favor of net neutrality rules. You voted to put them in place in 2015 and voted against the repeal, which is currently in place. Do you have plans to reinstate net neutrality in some form?
Well, like you said, I support net neutrality. I don't have any news to break on it right now, and I work at the helm of a commission that has only four members where we're equally divided on this issue, but I believe we will be stronger if we have net neutrality. Once again, the law of the land, working either through the Federal Communications Commission or Congress. Consumers, by and large, want to see an open internet, and I do too.
One thing we have seen over now the decades is this conversation ping-pong back and forth based on who holds the White House. Are you feeling like you maybe need to push Congress to take this action once and for all?
You know, I think things are always sturdier when they're written into law via Congress. But I also think that when the FCC chose in 2015 to update its rules and make sure that net neutrality was in its policies, that decision was ultimately upheld in the courts. So I think that the agency can move here too. It's not one or the other, but I acknowledge that an update to our laws is sturdier over time.
We are in this moment where, you know, a lot has happened, a lot has changed, a lot is changing. What opportunity does that present for you right at this intersection as you take over this agency?
It has never been easier to explain to policymakers in Washington just how vital it is that we connect everyone everywhere to high-speed broadband. And I think we have to seize this moment and say we're going to connect 100% of us and then plot a way to do it. Because coming out of this pandemic, it is clearer than it's ever been that this is the infrastructure every household and every community needs to have a fair shot in the 21st century.
Jessica Rosenworcel is the acting chairwoman of the Federal Communications Commission. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thanks for having me.
There is a lot more to my conversation with Chair Rosenworcel and all our coverage on how the internet is everything over on my other show, Marketplace Tech. The pandemic is receding in some baby steps and some really big steps. One of those big steps, the New York City subway resumed 24-hour service today after more than a year of overnight shutdowns for extra cleaning and disinfecting. Subway ridership is picking up, but it's still only about 35% of what it once was. And there are similar numbers in transit-heavy cities like Chicago and San Francisco. So what's it going to take to get riders back in the tubes? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
Studies haven't linked COVID outbreaks to public transit, but the thing that defines subways and buses, crowds and tight spaces, means one of the biggest hurdles in regaining ridership is public perception. Jenna Fortunati at Transportation for America says transit systems should continue concentrating on regular cleaning and masks.
You know, walk around the transit system and they pass out masks and just make it feel so welcoming and safe.
The CDC says everyone should still wear masks on public transit. The other piece of safety riders are worried about is crime. New York City announced it's adding 250 extra police officers to patrol the system. Sarah Kaufman at NYU's Rudin Center for Transportation says there's also safety in numbers, ridership numbers.
Once large crowds return to the subway, I think we'll see less crime because there will be less opportunity
Of course, ridership is also down because many office workers are still at home, and people who can afford it have been driving or using rideshare apps. Ben Fried at Transit Center says systems need to run reliably to bring riders back.
If they're out of the COVID mindset and they're ready to get back on transit, but then the bus they're waiting for doesn't come, they're going to give up pretty soon.
Mass Transit should have the money to hang on through the end of the year. The last stimulus package allocated $30 billion to public transportation networks, and they'll need that money to recruit. An aging workforce, pandemic layoffs, and COVID-related deaths and illnesses have left a lot of transit systems short-staffed. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up?
They just sit there like golf balls on a driving range.
Yeah, but now we got to pick them up. But first, let's do the numbers. Not a great day. Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 54 points, a tenth of a percent, to close at 34,327. The NASDAQ lost 50 points, three-tenths of a percent, to finish at 13,379. And the S&P 500 was down 10 points, two-tenths of a percent, to finish at 4,163. Now, we heard from Justin Ho that AT&T is combining those media operations with Discovery. AT&T was down 2.6%, and Discovery dipped 5%. Other media stocks felt that downward trend today. Hostess released its first quarter earnings this morning and reported a profit of $26.7 million. And that is thanks to people increasingly reaching for what the food industry calls indulgent snacks. We're not judging. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.65%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Back at the beginning of the show, you heard Scott Tong talk about how lawmakers are zeroing in on cybersecurity. President Biden also signed an executive order last week aimed at boosting cyber defenses in the wake of that big SolarWinds hack and, of course, the pipeline attack. But cybersecurity requires people. The unemployment rate in cybersecurity is close to 0%. The federal government itself has a lot of trouble finding and retaining cybersecurity pros. And some experts say we need to rethink the way we hire for these jobs. Aaron Weiss-Kaya is a strategist focused on cyber organization with the consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton. Aaron, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me today.
So tell me, there is thankfully increasing interest in improving federal cybersecurity programs. But tell me about the need for cybersecurity workers in the public sector. How big a deal is this?
So at this point, we're looking at a 0% unemployment rate. I would say on average, a cyber worker is getting upwards of 4 phone calls a week for opportunities. And the supply is far below the demand.
So is it that there aren't enough trained people? Are there pay problems? What are some of the blockers here?
It's really the growth of the field. When we look at cybersecurity, I think there's often a view of, oh, it's an extension of information technology. But in actuality, this is an emerging field that's only really grown to these levels in the past 10 years. And so keeping up with the demand with that amount of supply has really been the gap. There's a number of potential additional issues that I can kind of speak to in a little bit more depth.
What are some of the other issues that prevent people from coming into these jobs with the federal government?
So I think more often than not, it's how we're thinking about who can fit for these jobs. Mm-hmm. There's often a set of qualifications attached to a role that may not actually be necessary. We find that the individuals who are most successful in cybersecurity are not necessarily based upon the technical skills that they've been trained into, but it's actually based much more on having an aptitude around problem solving, analytical thinking. They tend to be individuals who are very adaptable. They are very effective communicators. They can certainly deal with some higher stress environments. And so thinking instead about the kinds of non-technical skills open up the door for a much larger talent pool.
So you're talking about, in some cases, skills-based hiring and a more flexible approach to hiring. Like, don't just put up a job description that says, you know, we need an awesome coder with a degree in cybersecurity, for example.
Yes.
I'm not even sure that exists. I don't even know if anybody's giving a degree in cybersecurity, but
They are now. But it's, right. Again, it's emerging. It's recent. Don't put that up. Don't put up the 7 certifications, because cybersecurity sometimes is much more a risk management role. So thinking about reskilling programs is another alternative to really grow what that pool looks like.
Erin Weiss-Kaya is a strategist focused on cyber organization with the consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you again for having me today. It's been a pleasure.
Electric cars are finally becoming more mainstream. On Wednesday, Ford will unveil what it's calling its most powerful pickup truck ever, and it's all electric, the F-150 Lightning. That's good news for reducing carbon emissions, but the batteries that power electric cars require metals that are hard to find and mine. The search for more could open up a new frontier for mining, the deep ocean floor. Companies are lining up to exploit the vast reserves of battery metals that are found there. But of course, some advocates warn that deep sea mining could have disastrous impacts on the marine environment. The BBC's Justin Rowlett has this report.
This is a hydrothermal vent tube worm. So this was found at about 2,500 meters.
In a laboratory in the bowels of London's Natural History Museum, zoologist Dr. Adrian Glover shows me a series of glass jars containing a few of the fearsome creatures he studies.
This is a giant scale worm.
Animals like these have inspired the sci-fi movie makers over the years. And as well as unusual animals, much of the deep ocean floor is covered with potato-sized black lumps called polymetallic nodules. Dr. Glover says these nodules represent a vast potential resource.
The seafloor is actually littered with these little accretions of minerals sitting there on the sediment. They're rich in cobalt, copper, nickel, manganese.
Some of the key metals needed to make batteries, which has put these polymetallic nodules at the centre of a debate about how to create our low-carbon future. Mining companies say they can access this vast resource more easily and in a less environmentally damaging way than mining battery metals on land.
These nodules offer many benefits. They lie on the ocean floor, so we don't have to drill or blast to find them. They just sit there like golf balls on a driving range.
Gerard Barron is the CEO of one of the biggest deep-sea mining companies, Deep Green.
We will impact, we think, around the top 5 centimetres, where we can lift the nodules. And of course, there's no forests or no plants. And we compare that with land-based mining, these areas of rich, biodiverse rainforests where we're having to destroy these carbon sinks to get access to these metal deposits. It's a no-brainer where we should be getting our metals from.
Many environmental campaigners disagree. Greenpeace sailed 1,000 miles into the Pacific Ocean to hoist banners beside Deep Green's exploration ship. It says deep sea mining will destroy ecosystems that took hundreds of millions of years to develop. BMW, Google, Samsung and Volvo Trucks announced they wouldn't be using any metals sourced from the deep ocean in their products. Jared Barron, the Deep Green boss, says he isn't worried. He believes car and tech companies will have to consider deep sea mining if they're going to move away from fossil fuels.
You can expect consumer-facing brands to get involved in this industry because they know better than anyone else that material shortages are the one thing that could put at risk this transition away from fossil fuels.
Crucial questions about the environmental impact of deep-sea mining remain to be answered. The final decision on whether it goes ahead will be made by the UN body that controls exploitation of the deep ocean. But as sales of electric vehicles increase, pressure on it to allow mining in the deep oceans is also likely to grow. In London, I'm the BBC's Justin Rowlatt for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. So there's closing the barn door after the horses have all escaped. And then there's adding a second lane to your canal after the giant skyscraper-sized ship got stuck for 6 days and disrupted global trade for weeks. At least the second one does have an ounce of prevention built in. Egypt has started dredging in the Suez Canal to make its single lane deeper and wider and extend a second lane to allow for, get this, more two-way traffic. I know. Good idea, right? All right, that's it for us today. Before I go, your moment of economic context on this Monday. A pandemic anywhere is a pandemic everywhere. That's actually what the word means. And with that in mind, the U.S. plans to send a total of 80 million vaccine doses around the world this summer. But this is a health and an economic story. Health officials and business leaders have sent open letters to President Biden this week urging our country to do more. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Molly Wood. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.